Chapter 2. A Phone Call. First, the facts. Both parents were from the strict Haredi Jewish community in North London. The Bernsteins' marriage had been arranged by their parents. 13 years later, the couple were now separated. Their two children, Rachel and Nora, lived with the mother but had a lot of contact with the father. After the difficult birth of the second child, the mother was not able to have any more babies. The father wanted a large family, and so the marriage began to fail. After being depressed, for a short time, she said, for a long time, he said, the mother did a university course and became a primary school teacher. The many relatives were not happy about this because in the Haredi community, women were not expected to work. They were meant to raise children and look after the home. So the family wanted the girls to live with their father. Haredi men did not get much education either. They did not usually go to university and were expected to spend most of their time studying the Torah. Haredi boys and girls were not allowed fashionable clothes, television or the internet, and they were educated separately. But the mother had already sent the girls to a mixed boys and girls Jewish school where non-Jewish children also studied. She wanted them to stay there and go on to university. She planned for them to have the chances in life that she'd never had and be able to earn their own money when they were adults. University would allow them to meet men who earned money and could help to support a family, she'd decided. Unlike her husband, who gave all his time to studying and teaching the Torah for 8 hours a week without pay. Mr. Bernstein's lawyer argued that Judith Bernstein was a selfish woman who could not separate her interests from her children's. What she said they needed was what she really wanted for herself. She was taking the girls away from a safe and happy home, strict but loving, with clear rules. Members of the Haredi were generally happier than people from the world outside, his lawyer said. Fiona looked up from checking the draft for a moment. No sound from the bedroom. Just the traffic and the rain. Fiona hated the way that she was listening out for him. The sound of a door or a step on the wooden floor. Wanting it, not wanting it. Fiona had made her judgment. She was known for being understanding, reasonable and highly intelligent. The Lord Chief Justice was even heard to speak to a colleague about her as distant and mysterious, but very understanding and still beautiful, although Fiona knew that she was slowly losing that beauty. She had ruled for Mrs. Bernstein. The court was being asked to choose between two ways of life, she had written. She had to take a long view, remembering that a child today could live into the 22nd century. This meant that education, the ability to work and have financial freedom, a large circle of friends and family, and chances at work were of most importance. The whiskey sat in the glass untouched. She had started to hate the smell of it. She should be angrier. She should be talking to one of her old friends. She should be going into the bedroom and demanding to know more. But she had to finish checking this judgment. No child was an island, she wrote. She thought of Shakespeare's play Antony and Cleopatra, nor custom stale her infinite variety. She knew the words well because she had once spoken them when she played Enobarbus in Antony and Cleopatra at Oxford one sunny afternoon, not long after she had finished her law exams. Around that time, Jack had fallen in love with her, and not long after, she with him. They first made love in a borrowed room at the top of a house with a window that brought in the golden evening sun. It had a view of the Thames River. She thought of Jack's lover, his statistician, Melanie. She had met her once, a silent young woman with a heavy necklace and stupidly high shoes. Was he obsessed with her? Would Melanie pull him away from home and eat him up, leaving nothing of past and future as well as present? Or would he be back within the fortnight, his hunger over, making plans for the family holiday? Fiona looked up and saw her husband on the other side of the room, pouring another drink. It was a big one, and he did not add water. He'd come in barefoot, so she'd not heard him. He turned and came towards her with the drink in his hand. His body still looked quite strong. He played tennis and lifted weights every day, while she did nothing except use the stairs at work instead of the lift. He was handsome in a messy way, with relaxed shoulders and bright eyes that looked for adventure. He sat down in the nearest chair. "You couldn't answer my question, so I'll tell you," he said. "It's been 7 weeks and a day. Are you really happy with that?" She said quietly, "Are you already having this affair? Because if you are, I'd like you to pack a bag and leave now." He knew that a difficult question was best answered by another. "You think we're too old, is that it?" It troubled her to think that he might be right. They'd had a good sex life for many years, regular and easy, on weekdays in the early morning just as they woke, at weekends in the afternoons, sometimes after playing tennis. It had been good for years and needed no words to describe it. It was one reason why she hated him to mention it now and had not noticed that recently they'd made love less often. But she had always loved him, always cared for him. Only last year she had looked after him when he broke his leg in a ski race with friends in France. She had even sat on top of him during sex in a hotel room in Paris while he lay on the bed smiling. But she did not know how to use these things in her defence, and she knew that this was not the reason she was being attacked. It was not her love he was questioning, it was her passion. Then there was age. They were not old yet, but the beginnings of it were showing. The white hair on Jack's chest and less muscle on his body. His face was a bit thinner and sometimes there was an emptiness in his eyes. And her own bottom getting bigger, her waist thickening and the corners of her mouth beginning to point down. This was fine in a serious-faced judge, but in a lover? "I don't think we should give up, do you?" he said. "You're the one who's walking away." "I think you have a part in this too." "I'm not the one who's about to destroy our marriage."
"So you say."
He said it reasonably, then swallowed some of his drink.
"You know I love you."
"But you'd like someone younger."
"I'd like a sex life."
She looked away and said nothing. She was not going to allow him to push her into having sex with him, especially when she suspected that the affair had already begun. He had not said differently.
"Well," he said, "wouldn't you?"
"Not with this gun to my head," she replied.
"Meaning?"
"If I don't start having sex with you again, you'll go to Melanie." She had not spoken the woman's name before. She saw his face go tight, and suddenly she felt ill. She pushed herself forward on the chaise longue, the judgment papers still in her hand.
"Well, if you were me, what would you do?" he said.
"I wouldn't start seeing a man and then ask to talk," she said. "I'd find out what was worrying you first."
"Fine," he replied. "So what is worrying you?"
It was the most important question, and she'd invited it, but at the moment it was making her angry, and she did not reply. Instead, she looked past him down the room to the piano, which she'd hardly played in 2 weeks. The photos stood on top of it in their silver frames. Both their families were there. Both sets of parents, his three sisters, her two brothers, their wives and husbands, past and present. 11 nephews and nieces who had their own young children. She and Jack had provided nothing. No one, except for organised family holidays and birthday presents. The nieces and nephews often came to stay, too. There was a cupboard in their apartment which was full of toys and a high chair. 7 weeks and a day. A period that began with the final stages of the conjoined twins case. 2 baby boys lay in hospital, joined at the stomach and thighs and sharing the same body. Matthew's heart was large, but it hardly worked, so Mark's heart kept them both going. Matthew's brain was small and undeveloped, and he could not feed very well. Mark was feeding normally and doing all the work. Without separating them, Mark's heart would soon fail, and both twins would die. Matthew was unlikely to live more than 6 months, and when he died, he would take his brother with him. The doctors at the hospital wanted to do an operation that would save Mark, the strongest twin, but would sadly result in Matthew's death. The loving, very religious parents refused to allow murder. God gave life, and only God could take it away. Everyone had something to say. Doctors, journalists, men and women on the radio, taxi drivers, relatives, people across the country. Life, love, death and a race against time. It was science against religion. Fiona found, in just under a week and in 13,000 words, a way forward. Separating the twins would kill Matthew, she said, but not separating them would kill both. Even if Matthew could live, it would not be for very long. It was a difficult part of the law because Fiona could make no decision to kill, so she argued that one child saved was better than two dead. The purpose of the operation was not to kill Matthew, but to save Mark. Matthew would die after the operation, not because he was murdered, but because he could not survive alone. The twins must be separated. Most people agreed with her decision. 2 days later, the twins had their operation. For Mark, it was successful, and he lived, and people slowly lost interest in the case. But Fiona was unhappy and could not forget about it. She had many sleepless nights turning over the details in her mind. At the same time, the angry letters from the religious side began to arrive, telling her that both children should have been left to die. Some even said that they wanted to hurt her. Those weeks had troubled her, and they had only just begun to fade. But the awful photographs of the twins stayed in her mind. She started to dislike bodies and could not look at her own or Jack's. But how was she going to talk about this? She could not explain why, after so many years in the law, this case had affected her so badly. She had sent a child from the world in 34 pages. For a while, some part of her had gone cold, along with poor Matthew. The feeling had passed, but it left a mark on her memory, even after 7 weeks and a day. She would have preferred not to have had a body, but to float in the air instead. The sound of Jack's glass landing on a table returned her to the room. He was looking at her calmly. Even if she had known how to tell him what was worrying her, she was in no mood for it. She had work to do, the end of her judgment on the Jewish girls to check. The problem was the choice her husband was making. She was suddenly angry again. "For the last time, Jack, are you sleeping with her? I'll take your silence as a yes." He stood up and walked towards the piano, then turned. "Nothing has happened. I wanted to talk to you first. I wanted..."
Do you realise what you're about to destroy?
I could say the same.
Something is going on and you won't talk to me.
Let him go, a voice, her own voice, said in her thoughts, and immediately she was frightened. She could not live the rest of her life alone. Two close friends, both divorced many years ago, still hated to enter a crowded room alone. And she still loved him, though she didn't feel it now.
Your problem, he said from the piano, is that you never think you have to explain yourself. You've gone from me. It would be okay if I thought it wasn't for long, or I knew the reason why. So...
He was starting to walk towards her when the telephone suddenly rang. Without thinking, she picked it up and heard the voice of her clerk, Nigel Pawling.
I'm sorry to disturb you so late, my lady.
It's all right, go ahead.
We've had a call about the Edith Cavell Hospital in Wandsworth. The hospital urgently needs to do a blood transfusion on a leukemia patient, a boy of 17 years. He and his parents are refusing the transfusion. The hospital would like...
Why are they refusing?
They are Jehovah's Witnesses, my lady. The hospital wants you to rule that it will be lawful to continue with the transfusion.
She looked at her watch, just past 10:30.
How long have we got?
After Wednesday, it will be dangerous, they're saying. Extremely dangerous.
She looked around her. Jack had already left the room. Then she said, List it for 2 p.m. on Tuesday. Ask the hospital to tell the parents.
I'll do it straight away.
I'll want to know why a transfusion is necessary and hear evidence from the parents.
She put down the phone, then went to the window to stare across the square, where the dark shapes of trees stood against the night sky. Street lamps created yellow circles on the pavements below them. The Sunday evening traffic was light now, and all she could hear was the last drops of rain falling among the leaves in the trees. She watched a cat move around a pool of water, then disappear into a neighbour's garden. It didn't trouble her that Jack had left the room. Their conversation had been moving towards a painful directness, and she was glad to be able to move to other people's problems. Religion, again. It had its uses. Since the boy was nearly 18, the age when, by law, he could make his own decisions, his wishes would be very important. On the other side of the city, this teenager stared at death for his own or his parents' faith. It was not her job to save him, but to decide what was reasonable and lawful. She would have liked to see this boy for herself, take herself away from her troubles at home, as well as from the courtroom, for an hour or two. The parents might be pushing him into this decision, and he could be too frightened to fight them. These days, finding out such information for yourself, as a judge, was very unusual. Back in the 1980s, a judge could still have spoken to the teenager alone in the hospital or at home. Now, social workers did the job and reported back. The old way had the human touch. Now there was less time and more boxes to tick. The lives of children were held by computers rather than humans. But a visit to the hospital was a silly idea, and she pushed it away. She went back to the chaise longue and read through the draft of her judgment one more time. It was done. She stood and picked up the whiskey glasses and went to the kitchen to wash them. As the warm water washed over her hands, she listened out for Jack, but could hear nothing. She went back into the sitting room and then found herself back at her position at the window. Down in the square, not far from the water that the cat had stepped around, her husband was pulling a suitcase with one hand and holding a briefcase with the other. He must have taken great care in leaving the apartment, inch by lying inch,
so that she did not hear him. He reached his car, their car, opened it and put the suitcase in the back seat. Then he got in, started the engine, and drove away. He must have packed his bag earlier in the evening when he first went to the bedroom. But instead of feeling angry, she was only tired. If she went to bed now, she thought, she might not need to take a sleeping pill. She went back to the kitchen, telling herself that she was not looking for a note on the table, where they always left each other notes. There was nothing. She went into the bedroom and opened the wardrobe. He had taken three jackets. In the bathroom, she did not open the cupboard to see what things he had put in his wash bag. She already knew enough. She slept badly. The face of the weaker twin, Matthew, came to visit her, staring at her angrily, as he had on other nights. The sisters, Rachel and Nora, were calling to her, and Jack was coming closer, telling her threateningly that she needed to do more for him in the future. When her alarm rang at 6:30, she sat up suddenly and, for a moment, stared without understanding at the empty side of the bed. Then she went into the bathroom and began to prepare herself for a day in court.